Hey, this is Dave Infante. Welcome to Fine Pairs Tap Lines, a weekly interview series with brewing icons, industry insiders, and outspoken experts about the United States' most beloved and best-selling beers. It's modern American history, one beer at a time. What's the difference between a beer and a cider, Tap Lines listener? I'm just kidding. I mean, I know the difference, but my point here is they're both fermented alcoholic drinks, right? They both have a rich history internationally and domestically. I like drinking both of them, and maybe you do too. Yet, the economic impact of the American beer industry is orders of magnitude bigger than its apple-pressing counterpart, and ditto the number of breweries compared to cideries nationwide. Crucially, there are precious few big-time brands with major marketing muscle out there evangelizing the fruit-based beverage to the American drinking public, and the retailers and distributors that serve them. This is a story about an exception to that rule. Joining Tap Lines today is Ryan Burke, the former head cider maker of Angry Orchard Hard Cider. These days, he's making cider under his own label in upstate New York, working as a co-founder of the beverage innovation firm Feel Goods Company, and serving the Cider Institute of North America as a founding board member. But midway through last decade, Ryan was working at Michigan's Virtue Hard Cider when Boston Beer Company tapped him to lead production on its in-house hard cider brand, Angry Orchard, which was then making one out of every two barrels of cider sold in the United States, according to a 2014 report from Beervana. In this episode, we discuss the evolution of the American hard cider business and Angry Orchard's controversial and, at this point, receding role in that evolution. Was the brand a vital gateway to broader acceptance of the category, or a millstone that limited what cider could be in the American imagination? Was it both? Was it something else entirely? Listen on, Tap Lines listener. It's Ryan Burke, it's Angry Orchard, it's the struggle for the soul of hard cider, and it's all right here, right now, on Vine Pairs Tap Lines. Ooh, do you feel that, listener? A sense of calm, a sense of tranquility has entered the Tap Lines virtual studio, and I think I know who's responsible. It's Ryan Burke. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, man. I'm happy to be here and bring the tranquility.
You're just, those who have never met Ryan, he's a very chill guy. I've had the pleasure of meeting you, what, Ryan, once in person, I think, out in Denver?
Out in Denver, drinking Pilsners, yeah. What was the name of that brewery?
Cohesion, I believe.
Yeah. So Czech Pils there was supreme.
That's a good way to describe it. It was delicious. But we're here to talk about a different beverage today. We're here to talk about cider, of course, listener, as you know, and a specific cider brand in particular, one that looms large in the American beverage alcohol landscape and in the convenience store coolers across these 50 states. I'm talking, of course, about Angry Orchard. Ryan, Angry Orchard has been a big part of your career as a veteran cider maker. You spent how many years? Seven?
Eight?
Yeah, eight years working on that brand during, I think, really formative years. And that's, I think, what we're gonna get into today. And I know I'm looking forward to it. I'm sure our audience is as well. Before we do, though, Ryan, you are by no means, even though your time at Angry Orchard has ended, you are by no means out of the game when it comes to cider. What are you up to these days, man?
Yeah, so took a little break, and my wife and I have started a small cider company called Occam, based here in the Hudson Valley, making really small amounts of cider in the way that we really want to for the people who really want to drink it. So very based on the season, i.e. we're not really coming up with brands that repeat year on year. Every year it's made based on the fruit that we have available to us. And so I'm lucky to be of this state and have grown up in, you know, the apple growing region of the state, or one of the apple growing regions of the state, Williamson, New York, along Lake Ontario. So a lot of people I grew up with are growing fruit and or have cider companies now, which is awesome. So I'm able to kind of look around the state and find fruit that I really want to work with growers that I know will grow it the way that I want. And I'm doing fermentations and blending without really brands in mind, but more, it's more palate led. And so it's for a type of person that is interested in constant change, rather than, you know, a regular brand that comes out every year or meeting any particular expectations, but rather kind of meeting the season with a palate and turning it into a delicious drinks. So we've just started bottling. We should start to release this fall, mostly direct to consumer. So sort of think like a wine club.
Yep.
is the goal. And, you know, ultimately the goal is to continue to make cider in an interesting way that keeps me and my wife, you know, turned on to making cider and to keep it really small. So no real plans to grow, but just kind of keep it where it needs to be to keep the lights on.
Well, wait a second, Ryan. Seasonal, not brand-oriented flavors changing. Now that sounds very scalable to me.
No,
What's going on there, Ryan?
Yeah. No, scale is not part of the story. Yeah, I mean, you know, the hope is that we are able to get a reasonable amount of people interested that want to participate with us and kind of grow with the project. So, you know, if 1,000 people in America care about it, then we're in a pretty good place.
Yeah.
Scale is off the table. You know, we do have dreams of building a place somewhere here in the Hudson Valley. But it's not a today thing. It's more a couple years from now thing. Mm-hmm. So we're going to keep it pretty small for now.
Right on. The brand that we're going to talk about today, the one that I mentioned just a moment ago, Angry Orchard, scale is very much a part of the story. And the reason, yes, I think it's really fruitful, no pun intended, to sort of frame up what you're doing now in context of what Angry Orchard has done in the American beverage landscape is because our listeners are a beer audience, first and foremost, although we like to not pander too much. We've talked about wine on this podcast. We talked about hard seltzer, of course. But they may not realize that there's, you know, when we talk about the cider segment or the category, such as it is, there's a vast chasm between, you know, what something like Occam is and what something like Angry Orchard is. And the reason I wanted to talk to you today, and the reason I think you belong on Taplines, you know, as our esteemed guest, is because that sort of spectrum between the two really, I think, has informed cider's triumphs and tribulations with regards to finding mainstream appreciation and volume with the American drinking public. And no brand, in my mind, although you're, of course, closer to it, no brand really represents that more, that tension more between, you know, scalability and artisanal, stay small, you know, seasonally oriented, et cetera, more than Angry Orchard, in my mind. And that's what we're here to talk about today, because we had Keith Villa on. Listener, you should go back and check out those episodes. The creator of Blue Moon, who was working at Coors at the time. Great episodes with him, a two-parter. And we talked about Blue Moon's somewhat contentious sort of place in the craft beer landscape, right? I mean, at first, it was leading the way. Everyone was excited. The BA was glad to, the Brewers Association was glad to get that course check. Yeah. Those checks always cleared. And then those early days, it was important to have a big brand like that leading the way, educating distributors, educating retailers, educating consumers. And then the craft beer industry sort of got its druthers and got its feet under it. And holy smokes, everyone's posting double-digit growth year over year over year. And Blue Moon became a bit of a pariah, a whipping boy, so to speak, sort of a too mainstream, corporate-owned gateway, yada, yada. Angry Orchard's story is not the same, Ryan, and there are vast differences between beer and cider, not only at the liquid level, but at the cultural and commercial level as well, and we're going to get into that. But this is the story I think that we're here to dig into. And the reason that I think Taplines listeners who are, you know, maybe more oriented in beer ought to pay attention to what's gone on in cider and what's going on in cider. So with that big wind up, I'm going to hand the Taplines. Yeah, this is, I'll shut up now. Sorry, listener. I'm going to hand the Taplines time machine over to Ryan. Ryan, when in your mind, you know, do we need to scroll back to get the Angry Orchard story?
Jeez, I mean, I think the whole timeline is Angry Orchard as a brand is probably the place to start, which is back in 2011. Boston Beer had cider before that under the name Hardcore, but yeah, I mean, I wasn't around for that, nor was I really paying attention, although I did certainly drink it back then. No, I think they just, it wasn't clear. Cider's opportunity, from my understanding, just was not totally clear at that time. But, you know, people started to take notice that there might be an opportunity. And that's when the brand changed from Hardcore to Angry Orchard. Things got a little bit sweeter. And then, you know, Angry Orchard got the push behind Boston Beer to become, you know, what it was in 2011. And there really wasn't, I mean, there Woodchuck was around and people will talk about that. It was around, but it wasn't around like Angry Orchard was then around. And so that was sort of the first rocket ship of that brand in the 2011, 12, right in there. Same time when we started Virtue Cider, actually. So it was sort of happening while I was getting my feet wet in the cider industry. And so I think there's that sort of big explosion of Angry Orchard. And then a second, you know, big explosion, which was with when Rosé happened later in 2015, 16.
Yeah.
Those are kind of two really big moments for that brand. And I think, you know, that Rosé moment happened and it lasted for about a year and things have kind of cooled down since then.
Yeah. Both within the wine segment or the category and, of course, Rosé ciders as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned Woodchuck. What did the cider landscape look like in your recollection, 2011, 2012? I'm thinking we had some of the British brands that were kind of sniffing around a little bit. They weren't doing significant volume. What did the shelf look like? What did the cooler look like?
It didn't look like much. I mean, it was mostly small.
It was a small cooler.
Yeah, small regional but important brands, people that have been around. I mean, it's not to say, you know, Woodchuck and certainly Angry Orchard were not the only ciders around, but by volume, they definitely were. And yeah, some imports, you know, Magners, et cetera. But, you know, those, they were around, but they weren't really around. Maybe find Magners at like an Irish pub or something.
Right.
So, you know, there's old stalwarts like Steve Wood up at Farnham Hill in New Hampshire. There were a bunch of small makers doing, you know, more like orchard-based, you know, seasonally or terroir-specific ciders, but you know, I'm talking 750s, low to no representation, probably not in the cooler, probably just local. Maybe, you know, New York City was seeing some of that kind of stuff. But
yeah,
I would say nationally, you weren't really seeing cider outside of those two brands and a little bit of import.
Yeah. What was your relationship to cider, Ryan, at, you know, in 2011, 2012?
I mean, my relationship is through my life has just been a product of where I grew up. My hometown, Williamson, was a dry town until 2005. And it essentially is the apple orchards for Mott's. So Mott's factory is in my hometown.
No kidding.
So growing up, cider was a deviant activity of the youth, you know, and so I was screwed around with it in high school and in college. And, you know, it wasn't like a, you know, I'm going to go be a cider maker. Or did I think there was some, you know, that path was never clear. And so, yeah, I mean, for me, it was like being in Chicago around craft beer and getting introduced to some English ciders, specifically Oliver cider of Tom Oliver, West Country England, Herefordshire. That's really when I started to taste things that interest me because of my interest in beer, which were mostly you know, Cantillon and everything that was happening, you know, in 2007, 8, 9, right around there in craft beer in Chicago. And I tasted those ciders and I was like, wow, this is, you know, eye opening. I've never tasted anything like this before. So I was pretty, you know, I was pretty nerdy on homebrewing and things like that. But I wasn't like trying to be a cider maker. In fact, I was trying to get into the beer industry in any way that I possibly could, which at the time in Chicago was like, okay, go clean floors at Goose Island or something.
Goose Island, yeah.
Which also everybody wanted to do. So like getting to clean the floor would be impossible. Yeah, yeah. And I did, and I never was able to like get in that way. Ultimately, I was able to get in because I met Greg Hall, who was on his way to start Virtue. And I started doing all of the... I basically was like, I'll do anything to be a part of this. And so I was pressing apples on a little hand crank press in a basement in Chicago, fermenting early ciders that would become Red Streak, the cider that we first launched. And that really pulled me in. So I came to it in a real, like, honest way, and that I'd been around apples and cider, but I wasn't, you know, it's not like I went to cider school. And, you know, Greg took a chance on me, and that's really how I got in the door. And ultimately, you know, we raised capital off the back of that first cider, and we built a cider house, and I was the head cider maker there, you know, after a year or so.
Mm-hmm. When does Angry Orchard enter the picture for you? Or when do you enter the picture at Angry Orchard, I suppose is the better way to say it.
So 2014 is when I first met folks from Boston Beer. They actually came out to visit Virtue to see what we had done. You know, at the time, no one had really invested in a place like Virtue had for cider. There wasn't a real beautiful tasting room yet. There are plenty now. But at the time, it really was the first kind of big deal, beautiful tasting room that had been built. And they came to see what we had done, you know, in lieu of them building what ultimately I would end up being a part of building and running for them.
Yeah.
So yeah, we just got to talking after that visit, and I came on board at Angry Orchard in 2015.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the backstory, I think, is pretty illuminating. And obviously, this is kind of like, you know, hindsight. You can't connect these dots at the time, but it's I think pretty interesting to me that the story we're here to talk about today is Angry Orchard and its tension, the tension that it represents for the ciders, you know, category between, you know, commercial commodity product and artisanal, you know, sort of pursuit. Hobby would be sort of a pejorative word. That's not how I mean it, but that's kind of, those are the goalposts, right, for cider. And that's always been something that I think the segment has been, or the category and its producers have been trying to figure out. You came from, when you entered the cider industry from the wreckage is not the right word, the aftermath of one of the most tense or angst-ridden moments in craft beer's own existential sort of debate over what it was and what it should be, which I'm talking about the Goose Island sale to Anheuser-Busch in 2011. Listener, you can go back and check out the nitty-gritty details of that acquisition and its implications for the Chicago scene and for the craft beer scene writ large across the country in our episode with John Lafler, who is now at Off Color Brewing, who is kind enough to sort of take us through the twists and turns of that dramatic saga. I just referenced that to sort of set up that, man, you kind of entered it in this milieu, and in another 10 years of hindsight, it's like, well, gosh, man, you got a couple looks at these types of debates that have happened in American beverage alcohol over what we should be, what this should be to the consumer, to the community, to the owners and employees, right? Like these are big questions that you got two bites at the apple here.
Come on,
I'm,
man.
I'm sorry.
Did you do this to Lafler?
I did. No, I didn't. I told them to hop to it. No, I did not. I'm sorry. I'll keep the puns to a minimum from here on out. Ryan, I apologize. Listeners, you knew what you were getting into. I don't apologize to you. So you join Angry Orchard in 2015 or so. The state of play at that time, things are starting to happen in cider, right? By 2015, yeah. there's some action. Tell us what it looks like then, 4 years after Angry Orchard sure. Comes to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the action was growing mm-hmm. during my time at Virtue, certainly. Like, I can remember being at CiderCon in Chicago and there being 30 people there. I just went to CiderCon last week, you know, and there were 1,000 people there.
Right, right.
And, you know, somewhere in 2013, 14, you know, that we started to tick closer to that 1,000 person number. It became a bigger conference, not just a couple guys in the room. Mm-hmm. So there was energy growing around the country. Certainly Angry Orchard entering and being successful sparked a lot of people to see an opportunity and said, well, geez, if, you know, this is working, you know, we should jump in too.
Yep.
And a lot of cider companies popped up all of a sudden out of nowhere based on, I haven't talked to every single one of these people, but I mean, I think we can assume we saw the success with Angry Orchard and cider. You know, big stories like Virtue certainly were a part of that too. Is like, man, maybe this isn't a category to jump into and find some success. And mm-hmm. the industry really started growing at that time. Most of the brands that jumped in were, you know, certainly smaller than an Angry Orchard, but there was a lot of activity and a lot of brands, you know, hopping on. Looking at like 2014, 15, I mean, that was a really active year for all cider. And I think, you know, 2016, 17 saw that rosé moment. And so a lot of people, again, you know, really, it looked like cider was just a rocket ship.
Yep.
That is not what's happened, however. You know, ultimately, I think, you know, Angry Orchard has declined. A lot of those brands that jumped in have grown. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of large regional
yep.
Cider producers now, but the piece of the pie is still about 1% of beer. So
it's tiny.
The category is just kind of eating itself. And so a lot of those big brands are serving as the local Angry Orchard, if you will,
yep.
To meet flavor trends of the week where they're at and get stuff into C-stores, grocery stores, and probably all the places 10 years ago they said they weren't gonna be making ciders they said they probably wouldn't make. But you know, I think it's interesting to see that these brands are able to fill the gap on a local or regional level to give, you know, drinkers in their regions something different than Angry Orchard that feels yep. More local and maybe more in tune with, you know, drinkers' wants and needs.
Mm-hmm. What was, when you came on at Angry Orchard, you're a little bit prior to the rosé boom, as you describe.
Yeah.
There's also, this is a moment where drinkers are also starting to think about gluten-free options, right? And, you know, like there's rising interest in that because whether it's celiac, which, you know, I think is always sort of part of the gluten-free story, or a wellness trend that makes people feel better, or they're doing it just because it's trendy, who knows? It doesn't matter. But the fact of the matter is people are more interested in it. You see, right? I pulled the Google like trend information back for the last like 15 years just to see sort of what it was looking like. And it didn't really spike super high in 2016, 2017, but it was planing upwards and continues to plane upwards even to this day. So people were having more, they were more interested in that. Cider has that piece of its value proposition, although I know there's... If you're not watching this, listener, Ryan just scoffed a little bit. He looked off to the side.
Yeah.
I knew this was going to be a controversial piece of the puzzle. But the reason I bring all this stuff up is just like, I'm curious, when you got to Angry Orchard, how were you guys thinking about positioning the Angry Orchard brand? Where did you see it fitting in? Shelf sets, like how are you talking about it to distributors? Give us a little bit, the listener, a little bit more context on like what this thing looked like from the inside at Boston Beer.
Yeah. Let me just pause and say the gluten-free thing, it doesn't hurt cider, at all. Right. Like we welcome, you know, your huddled masses. But you know, wine gluten-free does not have to lean on gluten-free, right? Where they're not like, oh, wine's the gluten-free, the gluten-free option when you're a beer drinker. They're not putting, maybe people are putting gluten-free on their wine labels. I don't know. I doubt it. Certainly,
I don't shop at those kind of wine stores. Yeah,
a fine wine from Burgundy, it does not put gluten-free on the back.
Right.
So the fact that cider always has to talk about it is just like mind-numbing to me. I'm happy to take the question, but I feel strongly that it's a detriment in that it gets put into this gluten-free thing that like then not like the not gluten-free set is like, oh, well, that's for gluten-free folks.
Right.
It's this claim that just like almost undermines how great cider can be.
Totally.
And we talk as an industry a lot like we're wine or we're close to wine. And I just look at that and I'm like, no serious winemaker is like leading with gluten-free when they talk about it.
Right.
Anyway, you know, it does bring people to the yard. I can't deny that. And, I'm sure it has brought some success to some cider makers. Anyway, there's been a couple ways that we've talked about cider as an industry, and I'll just speak to my own experience. You know, at Virtue, we were doing 750 mil, kind of higher end, $25 and up type, you know, bottles of cider, just a little bit of draft, no cans. Yep. And the story there really was alternative to beer. We wanted to capture the craft beer thing that was happening at that time and bring those drinkers over. Like, this is a complex and interesting beverage that is on the same level as the beers that you find interesting. And I can remember being at, you know, like Zwanzee Day and pouring a cider that was, you know, fermented 3 years in a barrel using Brettanomyces, all the cool words that the craft beer kids are using, and like standing next to somebody that was doing the same thing with beer, and the beer drinker being like, cider, I'm not drinking that. It's like, what I just said, Brettanomyces, barrels, wild, like what other cool words do I have to use to get you to like, so it was a constant struggle to get people to understand that we could do these cool things too.
Yeah.
But, you know, while we're doing that, Angry Orchard is out in the world telling people what cider is. It's gluten-free, it's sweet, it's bubbly on draft.
Yep.
And so that was really where people were getting introduced to what cider was. And so take it down to the craft beer nerd set. They've seen what Angry Orchard is and think that's what cider is. And so when we're talking about it, they're like, no, it's the sweet thing that I don't want.
Fuck you.
Yeah. Which I think, you know, I will probably talk about this more, you know, going forward, but it's like, you know, in that way, Angry Orchard kind of got in the way of the sort of like craft or more like local apple driven, farm driven cider.
Sure.
But when I got to Angry Orchard, we were still talking about it as an alternative to beer. I think, you know, one of my successes there was to change that part of the conversation and be like, look, we've done this for years. Cider is its own thing, and we need to talk about it like its own thing. It's its own thing. It is not an alternative to beer. It's an alternative to nothing. It's cider. This is cider, and we need to talk about it as such. And so, you know, we had a great brand team. We had just opened the cidery in Walden. We were in a place to, like, drive a more authentic cider story, and we did. Mm-hmm. We did with our wholesalers. We did on shelf talkers. I mean, we really, for 4 years there, basically up until COVID, we pushed a pretty authentic story around like traditional cider apple varieties, why they were important, why we use them to make our drink special, and why it was therefore different than anything else that was in the marketplace, i.e. beer or, you know, Reds, always trying to take a piece of cider, not cider at all. And so
neither is Busch Light Apple, by the way.
Right.
Thank goodness that's been discontinued. So there's no more confusion.
You know, so there was a, for me, it was an exciting time because we went from this like, oh, you like beer, try cider, to a, this is cider, try cider.
Yep.
And, you know, I keep referencing this sort of rosé moment, but like that was a key part. We had everyone's attention. I mean, that was the biggest launch of that year. And one of the biggest launches of the Boston Beer Company ever. I mean, it was insane.
Yeah.
It was insane. And so everybody wanted to listen to what we had to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm really proud of the team we had in place at that time that was like willing to listen to and find the right ways to develop a a story of authenticity in sourcing and in fermentation that allowed that cider to be both really successful and also tell a category story that separated cider from everything else. And yeah, I thought we did a really good job delivering that message all the way down, you know, from wholesaler to drinker.
Yeah. Were you say you're proud of the team, and I don't doubt it. Were you proud of the liquid on its own, like as it stood?
Yeah. I mean, look, Angry Orchard is for everybody. And, you know, there's the way that I always looked at it. I'll back up. You know, when they first asked me to come work there, I was no way. Like, is not who I am or what I do. I was like, Angry Orchard? I don't think so. But, you know, a lot of interviewing and just sort of like getting to understand where the company was coming from, how they were doing things, and just finding a way to understand it for myself that made me feel comfortable about doing it. One of those ways was certainly getting to build Walden, the cider house in Walden, and being, you know, having my laboratory and my orchards and, you know, able to do anything.
And you're back in New York and you're,
back in New York doing, you know, planting bittersweet apples, hiring an amazing team, making, you know, putting in a barrel program, like doing all that stuff. So I had this like craft place to go hide when I needed to.
But with
responsibilities to the national, you know, cider brand. Also, so like finding a way that it all made sense for me was looking at where the fruit came from. You know, as I mentioned, I'm from a little apple growing town that grows a whole lot of apples. I care first and foremost about the fruit and the farmer. And so, you know, for me, every drop of Angry Orchard that sells is more apples being sold and, you know, more money in the pockets of growers. So we, you know, when I got a handle on how we sourced and why, you know, I made cider in Walden that was for experienced cider drinkers, and I made cider for the grocery store that was for everybody. And I look at it holistically as hospitality, and I want people to enjoy cider. And to be honest, a 3-year wild fermented barrel aged blended cider for $30 at Walden is a different drinker than the, you know, C store Angry Orchard drinker. And I don't want to exclude anybody. And so the great honor at Angry Orchard for me was being to supply cider to an array of cider drinkers, an array of palates, get cider into places that, you know, this cool stuff I'm making in New York isn't going to play at a C store in the Bronx. And that doesn't mean they shouldn't have, you know, those drinkers shouldn't have cider. They should have cider. And I stand by the quality of that cider. Now, you could argue, and people certainly have, and I've been a whipping boy for the cider community at Angry Orchard. Everybody's got something to say, and that's fine, but it's high quality, and it meets a drinker need, and it brings joy in a glass, and I stand by that, and to me, that's like the highest honor I could ever have, is to serve the drinking community with what they want. Now, am I like more interested in making the 3-year thing? Yeah, for sure. But at the same time, the hospitality angle for me is really key to who I am and like what I want to accomplish in cider making. So the liquid standing on its own, I mean, that was a long development period. We didn't see rosé coming necessarily, but we started making rosé in Walden. That was a homegrown project with me and my team. We were playing around with all kinds of different ways to get that done, and there was no like edict to make rosé cider. We were just doing it because we thought it was cool.
No one burst out of a marketing meeting with a PowerPoint deck and ran over to Walden.
Eventually they did, but we were way ahead of it.
No.
We were probably 2 years ahead of that happening.
Gotcha. And,
you know, we did. Boston Bureau has a Christmas party, and you know, if everybody comes to the Christmas party, especially all the top brass. It's in Boston at the Sam Adams Brewery, at least historically. And if you want somebody to see what you're doing, you bring it to that party because everyone's going to be there. And we brought our rosé cider, which was made with blueberries at the time, and it was the first thing to kick out of everything that everybody brought, all the innovation across the entire company. And that was really the moment that the excitement started to build. And then, you know, the marketing guy burst in the door and it was like, we got to do this right now.
And like, so, yeah, man, we have been. We got it. Yeah. We're on it. Yeah.
So to launch what we were doing in Walden on a national scale would have been impossible. But I think, you know, we did a lot of research on what would work, what could work. You know, going back to like the team's willingness to find a way to tell a cider story, you know, we found the red fleshed apple, and that was the leading story. I mean, you know, I was on the TV cutting red fleshed apples open in orchards in France, right? I mean, we told a really unique story that was real. And so ultimately, you know, do I wish the rosé cider when we made it was less sweet? Yeah, of course I mean, I was always driving towards that. But yeah, I mean, the drinker tells you. And so, of course, at Boston Beer, we're doing all kinds of consumer research and sort of seeing drinkers' tolerances, thresholds on dryness, sweetness. And, you know, you kind of take that data and use it to hit the most amount of people with something they're going to like the best. And, you know, it worked. So standalone, yeah, I thought it was a great cider. You know, we've also... We took that same base and actually re-fermented it in a bottle in 750s and then disgorged it. So it was like champagne. And that same liquid turned, you know, it was just this like beautiful beverage that we then, you know, sold there as like a sort of higher end rosé, but it was the exact same cider base. So a base on its own from like technical cider making standpoint. Yeah, I was proud of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well answered. And I appreciate you taking that on. I'm curious, you mentioned sort of there are maybe two different cider drinkers, just like there are many different cider drinkers, just like there are two many different beer drinkers and every other type of beverage and type of product. But there's a spectrum, and at one end it's more broad in the American, you know, drinking public. It's going to be more sweet because the American palate is typically much more sweet than comparable cohorts in Western Europe or other parts of the world. It's going to be a specific type of product. And as you mentioned, you know, that can bring more people to the table, can bring more people to the yard, however you choose to say it, right? It's a gateway, as people talk about with Blue Moon. I'm curious, when you were working at Angry Orchard, or maybe when you were considering taking the job, or at some point during your time there, were you explicitly like thinking about its role as a banner carrier for the category? Like, when did you, because you talk about it now as, you know, we have a responsibility to the segment, we have a responsibility to the national brands, like we have stories to tell. Before you were working at Angry Orchard, you're like, gosh, it's kind of getting in the way maybe a little bit of what we're trying to do over here at Virtue. How did you start thinking about it once you kind of wrapped your head around a much more national view of where cider sat in the landscape?
Yeah, I mean, I always looked at it as, you know, like I said, I mean, it's a service and a responsibility. I think it does a lot of good to introduce people to the space. But I think Angry Orchard and other brands that are large now too, kind of, they've got the inroad to get in front of the most amount of people. But then you have a whole segment of this industry that doesn't and is making something that is maybe less repeatable from batch to batch. You know, it certainly doesn't have the, you know, marketing or sales push behind it. I think some of these like larger national brands can kind of get in the way of this other segment of cider. But I mean, that's also true of, you know, it's true of wine. I mean, you've got all kinds of big brands that kind of tell people what wine is. And then you have this whole other world of wine to explore.
Right. You've got 19 Crimes, which tells people that wine is about doing crimes. Right. And then you've got everything else. Yeah.
The thing is, cider isn't wine though. And so while that happens, wine has this cool party over here in all kinds of different spaces. That is supported by, you know, restaurant industry, supported by cool, you know, like raw wine and all the fairs that happen.
Everything. Yeah.
All that stuff happens for wine because wine's been around for generations and is a huge business, where cider is a small business and has only really been around in the US for 30, 40 years now. And so I think we just struggle then, cider struggles then. And I'm talking about that smaller segment of cider, the not national, regional, but smaller, call it craft cider. you know, it struggles to find its place and its awareness. And so while wine can go and party while 19 Crimes is being sold, cider goes to a pretty small party and a pretty low awareness. You know, we aren't part of the W set education. We should be, you know, beer's on there. We're not, cider's not there. So like you don't have the representation even in the cool craft places or restaurants where wine has a ton of awareness and like, you know, people learn about it and they take pride in their learning and they speak to their diners about the wine and it's a badge of honor to know it and to share it. We don't have that. So we don't have all these advocates all around the country talking about us all the time, as opposed to wine, which does all the time, no matter what.
Right.
And so when the big guys take up all the air,
there's no countervailing force.
No, yeah. I mean, that's what cider is.
Yeah.
Cider is, you know, and right now cider is not even really cider. Cider is, you know, blueberries, mangoes, papayas, all kinds of other fruits. Cider as the marketers. Base.
Yeah. The marketers might call that a flavor platform, Ryan. What do you think about that? You like that term?
Sure.
Or no?
Yeah. That seems like a nice way to say it.
Diplomatic. But yeah.
And so a lot of the cider that we have in the marketplace that's successful in cans at the grocery store, et cetera, you know, that cider is whatever the other flavor is first, and cider is a carrier. Mm. Now, back to me, you know, I care that those ciders are successful, and I hope they continue to be, because that means apples are being used and sold, sold and used, and that's great. But, like, does a really, you know, guava-forward cider say anything about cider? It really doesn't. Maybe it makes a delicious drink. That's fine. But it doesn't help the sort of underbelly of craft cider get awareness, or it doesn't really turn people on to that. It turns people on to the fruit flavored trajectory.
Right.
At which point that drinker is ready to switch over to seltzer or RTDs or whatever else. They're not probably not going to taste guava cider and be like, oh, I think I should go to the Hudson Valley and spend $40 on a bottle of Occam. You know, that's not the way that's not going to work that way.
Turning the guava imperial drinker into the wild fermented 3-year barrel conditioned 750 drinker. That's a tough one. That's a tough road to hoe. Yeah, as they say.
Yeah. And so, you know, so for cider then, a lot of the ways in on that kind of cider is with the wine, the cool kids in the wine world. And that has, people have found success there. So I mentioned Raw Wine, Wild World, all those kinds of places. There is room for cider to participate in the natty wine cool kid thing that's been happening. But then once again, I mean, I'm happy, but it says that we still need to borrow from another category to get awareness,
which is frustrating,
rather than our own. Yeah, I find it's what we got to do. So pull your boots up and get to work. But you know, it doesn't feel great after all these years. You know, I don't want to be cynical about it. I think it depends where you are. There's pockets of this country where, and you were just in Portland, although based on the weather, it doesn't sound like you were able to get out
I didn't see much. I didn't see a single cider on tap, but that's not because they're not there. It's because I didn't see any tap handles, because I didn't go to any restaurants.
You know, Portland is probably the best place to drink cider in the country. There's just, it is found its way in there. Local drinkers really care about it. So you'll see 3 and 4 ciders at places. None of them will be Angry Orchard. They'll all be, you know, the local ciders. And, you know, you have multiple tap rooms with, you know, Schilling has a tap room with like 40 cider drafts. And it's not just Schilling. They'll have cider from all around the world. So there are pockets and places where cider gets celebrated in the way that I wish it would, you know, kind of everywhere. Like in New York, for instance, not at all. We can't seem to keep a cider bar open. You know, so there are places and there are people that are pushing it. There are, you know, Redfield Cider Bar in Oakland. There's Scion Cider. I mean, there are these little places that are pushing these ideas, but we're talking about just a few. They're amazing, but they're not ubiquitous.
Yep. Are you at Angry Orchard when you start thinking about Occam? Like, when does the idea that, like, it's time to do something smaller hit you?
I mean, it started at Virtue, honestly. When Angry Orchard found me, I was already in, that was in my head at that time. I wasn't ready for that, but it was in my head. You know, and Angry Orchard gave me the next 8 years to figure all that out. Although I would say, you know, that was a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week job. So it was in the on the back burner, but it was in my head. So I kind of always wanted to. Thinking back to Chicago days, I mean, it was homebrewing, but, you know, we had a guy named Juan Kim, who's a chef. He was a chef at Whole Foods at that time. Now he has his own restaurants in Chicago. He used to throw these, I call them homebrew raves, because they were in warehouses and they were totally illegal. And he pulled together homebrewers, and he would cook food, and you would pay a ticket, and you would come and taste beers, and his food would be there. Everybody, almost everybody in that original group of people is now professionally making beer, and there's one cider maker, and Chef has his own restaurants. It was homebrewing, but it was a really competitive, creative space where you definitely showed up with something good or else.
Right.
And so when that was happening, I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do with my life. Whatever this thing is, I'm going to do this. And so it's been in my head since back then. I had no idea how to get there. And the last, you know, 11, 12 years of working for other people kind of helped shape what I want that to be and what I don't want it to be. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm excited and nervous to finally put something out under my own name. Much as all the ciders I made in Walden, you know, they would have never happened if I wasn't there. That program would have been something totally different. And, you know, I felt a lot of ownership over what that is. But the reality is I didn't own any of it. It wasn't mine. I got to claim it a lot. But in the end, I had a nice soft cushion of a $1 billion company behind it.
Sure.
And so now finally putting stuff out under my own name and my wife's name is a little daunting, to be totally honest with you. And some of it's, I'm probably just like putting that pressure on myself. But yeah, it's been fun and challenging to explore what it means to do my own thing and to do it differently as much as, I mean, not necessarily because I did something a different way in the past, but like, how am I going to do things differently? So it's not just the same old thing I've been doing for years and years. You know, we did a lot of focus on like European cider traditions, Spanish, French, English, all that stuff, which like was so much fun. And I got to travel the world to figure out how to do it. And I'd like to think we at Walden like really got there. We made some ciders that, I mean, identical to Spanish Sidra, which was like a 10-year project for me. The next thing I do, I don't want to come out the gate and just make a Spanish style Sidra that's just like what I did before. So finding interesting ways to do things very different has been the real challenge. So that there's a thread that goes through, but that the ciders are unique and kind of an evolution versus doing the same old thing over and over again.
Yeah. Brian, as a way of sort of summing up your experience and this podcast, the episode that we've gone through, you've taken us through your time at Angry Orchard. You described what you're going to be doing, what you're going to be putting into bottles soon with your new project. I'd like to sort of zoom out because, you know, I mentioned Blue Moon earlier in this episode. We talked briefly about Goose Island and its place in the craft brewing landscape and in craft brewing history. And Angry Orchard strikes me as not the same thing, but has some parallels, right, between it and those two breweries, as well as other brands, I'm sure. But those are the relevant ones to me at the moment. And like one of the things as I was doing research for this episode was struck me as there's like, you can kind of look at this within the frame of like a reverse mullet, right? Like it's like party up front, the cool shit up front, and then business in the back, right? And this model is something that people have tried to apply in a bunch of different sectors. One that comes to mind is BuzzFeed, which is a shell of its former self. But the idea was like, let's do the commercial shit, you know, the stuff that is going to drive clicks, the quizzes, the listicles, the, you know, whatever the fuck BuzzFeed got into, a ton of weird shit, you know, at its height. And we're going to use that money that we get from advertisers and events and shit to fund Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, journalism, right? So that's the business in the back part. Like, yes, it's not as sexy. Yes, it's always going to be probably a break-even business if we're lucky. But we need to underwrite this with, you know, with a real business here. And so what if we have to go broader and more commercial and less sophisticated to do so? That's media. And media is not the same, of course, as beverage alcohol, but Blue Moon has a version of that, right? Like Blue Moon is the cool thing that Coors is backing and writing the checks for. Goose Island, a little bit of a different situation, but after Goose Island gets acquired, that's when the barrel program, you know, becomes widely available to more people. That's when, you know, Bourbon County Stout becomes sort of this leading.
Oh, man. I still can't get over, even now. You know, I have Bourbon County Stout that I hand waxed in my basement right now.
Wow.
Back in like 2010. I'm that guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I waited in lines at Binny's to get my hands on that shit. And now I can just go buy it right now.
Costco.
At the CVS. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right now
at
the CVS. And it, every time I see it, no matter how many times I see it, it blows my fucking mind.
Totally.
It just
totally.
Blows my
mind.
I never waited
in the line, but I reported on some of that sort of frenzy for that product. So that's a perfect way of sort of framing up this conversation. On one hand, there's a sorrow there, right? Something very special has become something very common. On the other hand, more people than ever before will be able to drink Bourbon County Stout because of this, right? The party up front has gotten bigger, and it's due to the business in the back.
Yeah.
How do you think of that dynamic vis-a-vis your time at Angry Orchard? Do you feel like that's an appropriate frame? Do you feel like that misses pieces of what went on there? Tell me how that ranks for you or rates for you.
I mean, clearly what we did in New York would never be able to be done without the business in the back. I mean,
that place
is a, you know, top of the pyramid. That is one of the finest places in all of Babel across the world, in my opinion, certainly for cider. And if it was just a show, then I would just agree with you 100% or say that that's exactly it. I think the difference with Walden and Angry Orchard is that we really did invest in making that a center for excellence. And so, yeah, there was a party and it was flashy. You know, there's 1,000 people coming on a Friday and we built a treehouse that's on Treehouse Masters and, you know, Zac Efron came by one time and, you know, all that kind of stuff. All that's true. There was the marketing asset that was meant to be, the showy marketing asset, the place to bring wholesalers. All of that's there. But also there was and is, you know, a world-class team, a space and funding to push the boundaries of what cider can be, a 60-acre orchard of traditional cider apples that are, you know, that have the involvement of like Cornell as to, you know, what's going to grow well. Can we do mechanical harvesting? Things that can push the industry forward that benefit everybody, including Angry Orchard. You know, all of that stuff is there too. So while there's a party, there's some pretty serious things going on there that I think can help drive parts of this industry forward that, you know, I was really excited and proud to be a part of, you know, dreaming these things up and then, you know, in a place where I could not just dream them up, but, you know, make them actionable programs. And so, you know, the pure innovation of that company is, and the heart and soul of that company, of Angry Orchard as a brand, you know, didn't really have a place before then. There was no Angry Orchard. There was just, it's made at the same production facilities as everything else.
Yep.
There was just a brand team. And now, you know, there's a cider making team, which there just really wasn't. And every day when you drive into work, you're surrounded by this beautiful orchard that I hope continues to like drive home to the people that are there that this is a real drink that comes from a real place that is different than anything else out in the world. And so I think it stands for that.
Yeah.
And the cider making program, at least as I left it, was really a serious program that was constantly looking for new ways to innovate. So party, yes, but like serious cider production innovation facility at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a perfect place to leave it. We didn't get the black or white answer. We got the gray area, which is where I think Angry Orchard and others of its ilk, you know, the Blue Moons of the world, the Goose Islands of the world, I think that's the space that they so often occupy. So I think that's a perfect place to leave it, listener. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. Ryan, thank you for joining Taplines, man. Thanks for going the distance with us. Sure. You're welcome back anytime, my man. And best of luck with the bottling, man.
Thank you.
Very exciting.
Yeah. Back to bottling. It's been a while.
Yeah, yeah. Something small, something not scalable, something totally different. We're all excited, I think, to get our hands on it when we're able.
Thanks, man. I look forward to it.
Cool. Taplines is recorded in Richmond, Virginia, and produced by yours truly and Darby Seaside, who, along with the talented Shane Farrick, composed our delightful soundtrack. Just listen to it. I also want to give a quick shout out to the entire VinePair team, and especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mallon, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, managing editor Tim McCurdy, and art director Danielle Grinberg, who designed our lovely Taplines logo. And of course, a big thank you to you, yes you, listener, for spending time with us week in and week out. We literally couldn't do this without you. I'm Dave Infante, and I'll catch you next time.